Mother's Day is around the corner. Find the perfect gift for the mom in your life with a stunning piece of jewelry from Blue Nile. From timeless pearls to dazzling gemstones, Blue Nile has something she'll adore. Need it fast? Most items can ship overnight. Plus, enjoy guaranteed free shipping and returns. Don't miss our special Mother's Day deals. Save big on the season's most beautiful trends. For a limited time, get up to 50% off by going to BlueNile.com. That's BlueNile.com.
Hi, this is Craig Robinson from Ways to Win, and support for this podcast comes from Invesco QQQ, the official ETF of the NCAA. Invesco QQQ is proud to sponsor this episode and even prouder to provide access to innovation for the last 25 years. Basketball has had innovations over the years, too. We're seeing the game played in new ways every day. Learn more at Invesco.com/QQQ. Let's rethink possibility. Invesco Distributors, Inc.
Hello, everyone. It's been a minute, but you are back with the Telegraph Rugby Podcast ahead of the Six Nations kicking off this weekend. What ideal timing to have us back in your lives. You're joined once more by myself, Ben Coles, the Telegraph's rugby reporter, and I'm here with senior rugby writer Charlie Morgan. Hi, Charlie.
Colesy.
And Telegraph's rugby reporter Charles Richardson. Hi, Charles.
Hello and welcome back, everybody.
Charles, given that Charlie and I spent most of the gap between podcasts off on paternity leave, can you explain to us what's been happening in the last 3 months while we've been away?
International level, it looks like France and Ireland are going to continue dominating at club level, though their respective club sides have looked really strong as well in the Champions Cup. And Northampton, all aboard the Northampton Saints hype train bandwagon, playing rugby from the gods. Yeah, deserved numerous calls up in Steve Borthwick's England squad, and you've got to say at the minute favourites for the title, the Premiership title.
Charlie, instead of talking about the Six Nations, can you just expand on your love of Patrick Mahomes and the fact that he's off to a fourth Super Bowl? How do you feel about that?
I did manage to crowbar him into an article about who was going to replace Farrell's fly half of Saracens, if that gives you any idea.
Patrick Mahomes? Maybe.
Oh my goodness.
Will Lewis Rees-Zammit be there?
What, in the Super Bowl?
Yeah, I don't know how it works.
In the Super Bowl?
I don't really follow it.
He's got 2 weeks to learn the game, get a contract. Listen,
By all accounts, from everything I've read, that's just as likely as him actually making it.
I don't want to put anyone down. Maybe he could. He could get the Super Bowl. Seriously, though, we're delighted to be back. Delighted to have you listening. Just very delighted all around. There's loads of Six Nations coverage on the website over the next few days. So please have a look. Dig into that. Follow us for all of the latest stories and build up. It's a new World Cup cycle, and that means that things get a bit weird, don't they, Charles, in terms of old heads are gone, young faces are coming in. Who are you most excited about, I guess, if you had to pick a team or a player going through a bit of change?
I'm probably most excited about Italy, to see Italy, because obviously they looked very, very strong in the last Six Nations, maybe should have got that win. Didn't quite get there because they had their worst half of the championship in the game that they were most likely to win against Wales in Rome, and then they had a complete meltdown in the World Cup. Now, obviously, Gonzalo Casada's come in, new coaching team. That first game against England, I mean, it just looks treacherous for England, given that their injury list and how much we know Italy like to, how expansive and enterprising we know that Italy like to play. I'm sure Casada, who was at Stade Francais beforehand, will have some tricks up his sleeve. New faces, departures, and yet we're still going to have Weenie Antonio and Dan Cole probably starting at tight head this weekend in the Six Nations. Thankfully, there's a little bit of continuity.
You're not screaming bold, exciting New England era to me with that. You've said treacherous about a trip to Rome. What's going on?
Well, I just think, there's certainly a chance it could be bold and exciting, this New England era, but it's a bit up in the air, I would say. We'll wait and see what happens, and I think they will just want to get beyond that first game, get into the tournament. We've spoken a lot about how key momentum is in the Six Nations. Get that banana skin Italy away, potentially out, you know, get that off their back, as it were. Then you head to Twickenham against a Wales team where that squad looks a little bit lighter than it has done over the past few seasons. and then you may be looking at two wins and you can build from that. But it's with unavailability and injuries and selection quandaries, it's probably not been the most ideal January for England. However, they do have a coaching staff that could hopefully put those weaknesses to one side.
Yeah, Charles, right to touch on the coaches there. Felix Jones and Andrew Strawbridge are clearly going to have some sort of impact with England. Casada's a great mention as well. He was probably the star of my Six Nations launch last week in Dublin, just how he spoke about things. The one quote that stuck out to me was, I'm a Latin. I'm gonna bring that passion, especially for our defence, because that was the area that actually just totally collapsed for Italy at the World Cup in those games against New Zealand and France. But also, if we're looking at players, I think that's where the sense of renewal, excitement comes in at the start of the World Cup cycle. Just to quote Russ Petty to get me going, follow Russ Petty on X, he'll enrich your tournament. But 34 debutants in the 2020 Six Nations, the corresponding Six Nations of the World Cup cycle, 36 then across the subsequent three tournaments. So this is the tournament traditionally where, you know, where these debutants are blooded, and then, although we hate talking about cycles, that becomes tedious because of this blinkered sort of view towards the World Cup. This is really the opportunity for coaches to kind of lay a foundation to go for the next 3 years.
Do we have to call it X now? Can we not just call it?
That was quite seamless.
Yeah, it was the artist formerly known as Twitter.
You did it so naturally that I hated it.
It's time,
Charles. Just before we dig into a bit of England chat, you've watched the Netflix documentary, which
for my sins,
and you've reviewed it from start.
No, that's harsh.
To end,
that's harsh.
I thought you. I mean, you didn't put stars on your review, but can I guess? I would guess that you would have given it three,
probably on a generous day. Two, ooh, if I was feeling a bit grumpy, okay. It's probably 2.5. I think it's a decent enough first stab. I think the obstacles, while Netflix has not made too much of a big deal, and the Six Nations hasn't made too much of a big deal about those obstacles, I think we all know what they were. I think there was a little bit of fear and trepidation among the teams and among the unions at opening their doors fully to these camera crews. But the good news is, as you'll read on Telegraph Sport this morning on our website, that the viewing figures last week were excellent. It was the third most watched programme in the UK. It was the number one most watched programme in Ireland and fourth in France last week. By all accounts, it took Drive to Survive, the Formula One's equivalent series that Rugby Union is trying to mimic. It took Drive to Survive two or three series to get to that sort of level. So that, in terms of ratings and viewing figures, that does bode very, very well. We know that the camera crews and the production crews are with the squads now, and they've been with them since the Six Nations launch in Dublin last Monday. They travelled to Spain with England and to Portugal with Ireland. We know that the series has not yet been recommissioned, but those viewing figures and the fact that the camera crews are in camp with the squads, you know, it's a boost for them. And the optimist would say it could and maybe should be reviewed for a second series. I would like to watch a second series because I think that the drawbacks of the first series are quite easily fixed. It's too long. There are 5 rounds and 6 teams. You don't need 8 episodes. Waiting till the third episode to introduce France and Ireland, the two best teams in the championship, and with the best player in the championship, and they played one of the championship's greatest ever games in Dublin last year, was an error. And I'm not sure it wasn't quite gripping enough for a neutral, and it wasn't quite insightful enough for a rugby fan. It was sort of a bit of a grey area. It was sort of, you know, robbing Peter to pay Paul almost. So if they tidied that up, and focus more on the things that make rugby great, the characteristics that make rugby great, the camaraderie, the kinship, the team spirit, and all those things that are very difficult to show in a documentary, in fairness, they could be onto a winner. They focus on the individual too much, and I think that rugby is not a sport which lends itself particularly easily. The players are not at ease talking about themselves. Maybe they need to be better, but then the argument that I would put forward is that rugby does have many, many, you know, sundry qualities that are based around a collective. And if the documentary producers focused more on those qualities, then the individuality that they're craving would shine naturally. It wouldn't have to be artificially sort of projected and thrust to the viewer. Anyway, that's it. That's my rant over.
I think that's very good. I think that's good as somebody who's watched it. The only point I thought about as you were saying that was, I guess it's not necessarily... It feels like it's designed for like someone who watches the Six Nations and a World Cup, but not necessarily rugby week to week, or someone who doesn't watch rugby at all, if that makes sense. Like, it kind of feels like it's in that like middle ground where it'll hopefully entice more people in to watch it a bit more. And that's probably a good thing.
I think it's a fair question to ask, having watched it, as you've touched on that, who has this documentary been made for? What is the target audience here? If it is 18 to 24-year-old Gen Z, where rugby is sort of falling behind, those who don't know rugby that well, I'm not sure it's good enough to attract them. But is it good enough for the casual rugby fan? Yes. Is it good enough for the real committed fan, the proper loyalist? Not sure.
To bring you back crudely to NFL again, I think as a sort of...
Can't stop it.
who came into that sport as a newbie and was sort of was introduced... through a lot of these all-access documentaries, I think the access point is so important because that's where stars come from organically, I feel. And the point Charles makes there about having the stars projected onto you, I think, can be a bit stifling. That's all I'd say.
Yeah, you almost, if you're going to do it, you have to really open the doors. And also maybe for the second season, just do some background checks to see if any of your players are going to go to the NFL by the time the series comes out.
The serious point there is that big lag time. A year is such a long time, and we've got more documentaries coming out, haven't we? There's one on the World Cup referees. That's going to be more intriguing for how recent the subject matter is. And then we've got one on a little bit further down the line on Australia's World Cup coming out, I think, at the end of February.
Looks fun.
Looks really fun, and it's fresh in our minds, the World Cup. Fresher in our minds than last season's Six Nations.
We either said it on the pod or we said it at the time when they announced it was going to happen. We're like, that's quite a big gap between when it's being filmed and when it's being done. And I guess we're seeing that. Sorry, yeah. Charles, just finally.
I will quickly just go into bat. I agree with what you've both said and the wait is too long, but I'll quickly go into bat for the producers here because I don't think they could have released it during the World Cup. You know, that would have been sort of completely self-defeating. So therefore, they've delayed it to tee up this year's tournament, this year's championship, to tee up 2024 Six Nations and get people talking about the championship before the next edition starts on Friday in Marseille. I think that's the thought process behind the timing, and I don't think it's too flawed. I think they have their hands tied slightly.
So feasibly, there could be a second series by the autumn. I don't know.
Yes,
I'm just feasibly speculating. Coming up, we will be speaking to none other than Eddie Jones. We're excited to hear what the former England coach makes of this year's tournament, and we'll also hear from Italy's Sebastian Negri as well, one of the stars of the recent Netflix series. He's been speaking with Charlie. Before all that, though, let's get stuck into England.
Just a quick disclaimer, listeners. We recorded this before the news of Marcus Smith's injury came out from Girona, so just keep that in mind when you hear our discussions about England's selection.
Okay, Owen Farrell is not involved. Courtney Laws is retired. There's a new captain who I think we all agree was a good choice to be captain because we weren't sure who else might be captain. So he seems like an excellent fit in Jamie George. Charlie, let's just talk about that kind of change in leadership first, because I think that's going to be more important than maybe people realise. How big is that?
Yeah, it's hugely important. And you feel sorry for Steve Borthwick a little bit because he was kind of... You don't want his whole England reign so far to be about making excuses and making compromises for what's happened before, but he has got another tough set of circumstances thrust upon him. In Owen Farrell and Courtney Laws, they're not only losing 220-ish tests, they're losing two different leaders. You know, you've got an emotional kind of a tenacious emotional leader in Owen Farrell and somebody who's in Courtney Laws who's a lot more laid back and, you know, do as I do. His performances over the past 18 months and up till now have been phenomenal. He's had a long, long career. We've spoken so much about how he's reinvented himself as a player over that long career. And amazingly, he's hitting peak career best form now, which is just remarkable. I think there were two options, weren't there? For Borthwick, he could have done what Gatland did and who's gone with Dafydd Jenkins as a real... Line in the sand, this is a new era, we're working towards 2027. Gatland has obviously done that before in the past with some success in appointing someone like Sam Warburton. Jamie George has got the air of a kind of transitional captain, but he's super popular. You know he's going to have a hugely integral role to how England go because he played pretty much 80 minutes of those big games in the World Cup, and now that Luke Cowan-Dickie's gone down injured, he's the most experienced hooker there by a long, long way. Steve Borthwick's value on the line out makes him even more important again. So, yeah, it does feel, I've seen a lot of people sort of go, oh, that's kind of a bit underwhelming because it's just such a bridge. You know, it's not kind of, not this line in the sand, but I think England are going to have to kind of have to strike a bit of a compromise, and that's kind of what that appointment says to me.
We've worked with Jamie George for a long time, obviously, as a player, and he was almost the player in recent years when things were tough who sort of got wheeled out in front of the media to kind of diffuse any potential situations. The most recent example I can think of was after the defeat to Ireland in Dublin in the warm-ups, where he was the sort of the player who came out and was like, look, guys, we know.
It was laughably regular, though, yeah. By the end. Well, yeah, I remember one of the corresponding point a year prior to that, Stade de France. He was a guy that, you know, it was a Zoom then, because obviously, but he was going, yeah, look, we are working hard, I promise.
I assume he was front of house after the France game at Twickenham in the Six Nations when they got obliterated, but I can't remember.
No.
But basically what I'm saying is he's sort of become this almost like this politician who sort of comes out and I mean it's in a good way, sort of like tries to get the message across about what England are achieving, which is quite interesting. Charles, with no Farrell as captain, you also don't have a kind of a fly half again. One day we'll stop talking about England sort of midfield fly half selection conundrums.
We'll just
have one. But your options now are George Ford coming back from injury, Marcus Smith in very good form, Finn Smith tearing up trees with Northampton. So neck on the line, who starts in Rome this week?
I would start Finn Smith. I think he's been outstanding for Northampton this season and has shown a maturity and a level of game management that I think is not necessarily shared by Marcus Smith, although he has hugely improved in that regard as well. I mean, you look at some of his performances for Quinns just before Christmas and he was absolutely outstanding, but I think back to Finn Smith for Northampton at Thomond Park against Munster in the driving rain, 14 players. I mean, that's as near to sort of test conditions as you're going to get. Backs against the wall, and he marched them around the park. It was, you know, it was O'Gara-esque on the same field, really. It really, really was. And regardless of his dual qualification status, I think I would be really, really tempted to hand him the keys. I know it's a risk because he'd be a debutant away in Rome.
It's
on
quite,
the opening
quite
weekend.
Un-Borthwick-like to take, yeah, a risk like that.
Quite, it is un-Borthwick-like, but it's also pretty Borthwick-like to back who you think is the best player and not sort of you know, take much of account of the unmeasurable, intangible qualities. You know, he would see how well Finn Smith played in that Munster game, and not just in that Munster game, there's other games, but just using that one as an example because I think that's as close as it's been to test rugby.
Talk about Steve Borthwick kind of being pragmatic in that he will back form players. I think he will be really wary of how well that Saints contingent has gone as a collective, and I think Furbank has just been really important to that. It's looking like, as Charles said, Dingwall is the rookie who will be in almost by default because of the number of injuries and elevated ability in midfield. Again,
no,
that's not
midfield.
that's not to, you know, denigrate how well Dingwall's been playing. He's a super, super clever player, versatile, switches in around 12 and 13 with Rory Hutchinson for Saints. And he's been in and around the England setup for ages, despite being a fairly young guy still. So, If Dinwall's going to be there, if Freeman's going to be there, if Alex Mitchell's going to be there, I think Furbank being there is quite a sensible choice as well.
In an almost perverse twist of fate, I think that Furbank is almost a victim of the injury situation, because I think if it was Manu and Ollie Lawrence at 12 and 13 with everybody fit and firing starting, then he might have looked at Furbank 15 owing to that extra distribution, because obviously he's played fly half, he's much better distributor, much more of a ball player than Freddie Stewart, but he's probably really going to have to pick Henry Slade in the midfield, because really there aren't really much other options. So therefore you've got your distributor, you've got a ball player, so you can get away with Freddie Stewart at 15, can't you?
For another year, I find Freddie Stewart just a really fascinating piece of this England side, because we know his super strength is fantastic, probably unrivaled apart from Hugo Keenan as far as taking high balls and being commanding in that area. However, I'm not sure how much he's kicked on as that link man, and he probably has a little bit at Leicester. You want more to just bring more out of the back line that they've got. And Fairbank certainly does that. What I would say is, although Borthwick is super fond of Freddie Stewart, and he's, you know, Freddie Stewart helped him to win a Premiership title, which has been a turning point of his whole career, Steve Borthwick, he also didn't pick him for the World Cup quarterfinal. He went for Marcus Smith on the bench because he felt that England needed that little bit more help moving the ball wide, didn't he? So, yeah, that is, there are amazingly intriguing selection quandaries all around this England side, and 15 is just another one of them.
It's quite fun, isn't it? Especially the Fairbank story. I love a kind of mini redemption story, and given his last two appearances were starting at fly half against Tonga and then being chucked into the side at the end of that 2022 Six Nations, and they were like, oh, do you want to play fullback, when he hadn't played the whole championship. I think it'd be great to see him involved. It's a funny tournament in terms of England seem to have a lot of uncapped players who are eligible for other teams, and normally you get one or two, but there's kind of three with Finn Smith and Dingwall and Faye Webosu on the wing. The cynical part of me wonders whether against Italy they just try and cap all of them, just because then that risk sort of goes away, especially Dingwall with the form that he's been in. I don't know how close he was to being called up by Scotland, and Rory Hutchinson's obviously gone back there, his Northampton teammate. And it's going to be interesting with Faye Webosu in particular, because that caused a bit of a stir. Charlie, can you see him starting in Rome?
It's a difficult one. What I would say is two things. One, that Steve Borthwick volunteered him explicitly when he didn't have to, as a player who'd impressed him in the Premiership. There were three players that came out of his mouth, first of all, which took everybody pretty much in the media room by surprise, because this chatter about whether Faye Webosu would choose England or Wales felt a bit premature, regardless of how he was playing in the Premiership. But he brought up Faye Webosu, brought up Ethan Roots, and he brought up Greg Fizlau. Now, Greg Fizlau hasn't made the wider squad. Ethan Roots has, and Ethan Roots has got a lot of praise from Steve Borthwick since then. With Faye Webosu, the second thing I'd say, the first thing is that Steve Borthwick seems to have tracked him for a long time and seems to have been really proactive in how he's contacted him and got him now ahead of Warren Gatlin. The second thing is that he is playing in a really aggressive out-to-win blitz system with Exeter Chiefs. That would seem to me to fit what we suppose Felix Jones will bring in as defence coach. And he's, as well as that, he's very proactive when his side has the ball, picking up touches around the ruck. Will Greenwood compared him to Sevi Reese, the All Blacks winger. He's even got a bit of a touch of the Mark Talayers about him, which is a huge shout, because Mark Talayer was one of the standout players of the World Cup final. But there are, as ever, reasons why Steve Borthwick has picked a player, and I'm totally sitting on the fence as to whether I think he'll play. There's a slot there at right wing with Johnny May's retirement, and he suits it.
Charles, you've got seven uncapped players in this squad, and I know we've just talked up the how well Finn Smith and Dingwall have been playing. Might Ethan Roots actually have the biggest impact, just because of that kind of slot at blindside flanker, where it seems a bit uncertain about what England are going to do. They could play Tom Pearson there and have Sam Underhill at seven, or they could give Roots a go from the off, and that would be quite an impressive story, wouldn't it?
Yeah, absolutely. You know, he's another who's dual qualified with New Zealand. Yeah, he must be, because he's born in New Zealand, wasn't he?
Yes. Yeah.
But he's been excellent form for Exeter this season. A real find for them from the Ospreys. You know, Exeter have been going really well. The makeup of the back row is a strange one. You would assume that Ben Earl will reprise his World Cup role at number eight, and then it is massively up in the air. I think had George Martin, Ollie Chessum and Maro Itoje all been fit, there would have been a real temptation to play one of those three at six, with Earl at seven. Obviously, Tom Curry's out, and then either Ben Curry, Sam Underhill or Pearson at seven. But George Martin obviously is injured short term. Said the press release. It's massively open there. Pearson has not played a lot of six. Roots and is not a sort of frontline line-out jumper, and we know how important that is in modern day rugby to have that third jumper. So Roots could easily get it, and what a story that would be. I think that Underhill surely has to be the front runner at seven, although he's had a couple of knocks, but I think he has to be the front runner to wear seven, and then it's probably a shootout between Pearson and Roots at six. Ben Curry in the conversation as well. I mean, he could pick three sevens easily.
Mm. In these times of change, quite comforting to have a front row of Joe Marler, Jamie George, Dan Cole, just making sure everything's okay.
That's interesting as well, because we know Borthwick is about sort of balance in his selection, and really explicitly, and whether that is, sorry to those front rows that you've just mentioned, whether that's something like mobility that he balances out with a kind of quicker back five.
What are you saying about Dan Cole?
I didn't want to say it. Or whether that's experience. So whether that, I mean, for instance, it was just such an explicit call to have experience in his back three for the World Cup, wasn't it, with May and Daly. And for that reason, I think only one wing slot is open, because I think if there are going to be new faces elsewhere in the back line, one of the, and this could look really stupid, one of the safest calls would be to have Elliot Daly continuing in that left wing spot.
Yeah, that makes sense. 2 points on England I want to finish off on. Henry Slade's performances back in the squad sort of hinted that it was almost a bit of a necessity, because, you know, there's no Ollie Lawrence, Joe Marchant's in France. I don't know which of you's watched more Henry Slade recently, so I will just toss this up in the air for whoever wants to talk about it. Why is Henry Slade back, having not been in the World Cup?
I think he's very unlucky not to get to the World Cup. So one reason is because he would have been very close anyway. Second reason, Joe Marchant isn't there, obviously, with Stad. Third reason, he's looked really influential in a really kind of calming, assured way for a young Exeter side. He's very versatile. He's been as Will Greenwood again mentioned in our player profiles on our website, he's cutting a few kind of tough kind of uncompromising running lines in heavy traffic, which is going to be handy, because England don't have Tuilagi or Lawrence or anybody like that to do that job. His left foot has looked gorgeous, and we'd know that's not news, but Exeter have used it very, very nicely on Wipers lines. He's even had kind of spells in games, very brief spells in games at 15, where that's been a big weapon. So a lot of reasons. And he was another one of the guys that right at the beginning of January, so even before he named a squad, that Borthwick highlighted.
And just finally, it feels like England couldn't have brought in two more different coaches personality-wise than Felix Jones and Andrew Strawbridge, based on what we're hearing about Andrew Strawbridge. He seems like the kind of character who's really going to provide a bit of levity to the squad, as well as a lot of technical detail, whereas Jones, if you hire a defence coach who's just won two Rugby World Cups, obviously you expect a lot. Can you outline for me how he's going to change the way England play and what we're going to see from him? Charles, if I come to you first.
Well, it was certainly, they'll have done their homework. You know, Borthwick has already spoken about how intense Felix Jones is, and if Steve Borthwick is saying that, then you know that Felix Jones is going to be an intense guy and very obsessive and detailed. So they will surely have a few tricks up their sleeve. I remember before the World Cup last year, Borthwick saying that there'll be a few things at the World Cup that we do that people wouldn't have expected from us. And at that point, I did sort of take him at face value, because in that, you think back to his time at Leicester in that Premiership final, they did bring a few tricks out of the sleeve with Richard Wigglesworth, but we didn't really see it with the way that the World Cup panned out and the way that the games went. We didn't really see anything that we didn't really expect from them. And I wonder now, Marcus Smith at 15 would be the anomaly to that. We didn't see that much, but I don't think it changed the way that they played that much. Gave them a bit more width, maybe, and just allowed them to move the ball better. But they didn't. Arguably, they didn't use Marcus Smith as well as they could have done at 15. But having said that, in this year's Six Nations, I think there will be a few tricks up the sleeve. I mean, with how the starting 15 is going to be, with the amount of bodies missing in that back division, I think they're going to have a few tricks up their sleeve if they are really sort of chatting about themselves as title contenders and championship contenders, they're going to be really smart with the way that they play, especially with also, I'm certain that a month ago, Alfie Barbary would have been front and centre of the plans to at least compete for the number eight starting jersey and give a real heavy duty ball carrying option. They're not going to have that by the look of things, unless Alex Dombrandt starts at eight, but even then he's sort of more of a loose player, isn't he? So they're going to be playing quickly, they're going to be playing fast and loose, you'd expect, and just be really detailed about at the breakdown. And someone recently, was it Jamie George, who said that the defence is going to be completely different? You're going to see a completely different...
Jamie George,
it was yeah. Jamie George who was saying that England's defence is going to be completely different in this year's Six Nations, and you probably get the feeling it's going to be much more intense and much more aggressive. Having said that, against South Africa in the World Cup semi-final, it was pretty intense and pretty aggressive. So if it's going to get even better than that, then without the ball, I think England fans will be in for a treat.
Just finally on England, what's an acceptable tournament if we think about the schedule and who they're playing up? If I think three wins would be good, actually. Charlie, what would you think?
All roads lead to Murrayfield, I think, and that's certainly not to overlook how threatening this first weekend could be for them, because Italy have never beaten them. They will have new coach bounce, all those sorts of motivations. Get over the line at Murrayfield. England can be really pleased with themselves, and three wins for third be pretty respectable, I think.
It plays out well quite nicely, doesn't it? Because they have Italy, Wales, Scotland. So if you can build that momentum through the three games, maybe have a crack at the other two, who are clearly far more further along in their development than you, and see what happens.
Yeah, no, I agree. I think that third is probably sort of bare minimum. I think if fourth would be a disappointment, I think. I think third would be acceptable, third would be par. I think fourth would be a real disappointment, because then you've probably only won two games.
The first two.
Yes, and perhaps the first two, and then lost three on the bounce. You're right, all roads lead to Murrayfield. They could quite easily go to Murrayfield and lose. Of course, this is an excellent Scotland team. However, they will also be thinking that they could quite easily go there and win, especially if the conditions suit them more than they suit Scotland. Scotland like to play very expansively, and if England are really detailed, and if they go in with a strategy like they had in that World Cup semi-final of just trying to sort of win the game at the expense of potentially not being too entertaining at Murrayfield, then there's no reason why they couldn't win at Murrayfield. It's going to be tight. It's going to be tight. It could go either way, and it's already shaping up to be an absolute belter.
Ahead of this weekend's clash, let's get some insight now into this weekend's opponent, Italy. Sebastian Negri, star of the aforementioned Netflix series, has been speaking with Charlie.
Seb, hello, welcome to the Telegraph Rugby Podcast. How are you? A few days out now from Six Nations opener. How are preparations coming along?
Yeah, no, all good this side in Rome. We got you 2 days ago. Nice to be training in the sun. But really excited for this weekend. Obviously, we are under no illusions. It's going to be a tough tournament, but one we're looking forward to.
Seb, one big strand of the build-up to this year's Six Nations has obviously been the Netflix documentary Full Contact. At the risk of embarrassing you, you're one of its stars. What's it been like for you? I imagine a reasonably new experience building up to a tournament when you're headlining in a Netflix documentary.
Yeah, it's been a bit surreal, I guess. I've been obviously taken back by a lot of the support and all the feedback that I've been given. It's been pretty special. Just people getting in touch and saying how proud they are, and people that have known me, not recently, but from the beginning. So, that side of it's been pretty cool. Obviously, getting quite a bit of stick off the boys, as one would expect. It's been a really cool experience. Obviously, not used to any of that, but I think it's a really good thing for rugby. And I think it showcases to everyone that we're just human beings away from what we do on a Saturday. And I think the audience, I know from the feedback that I've been given, is just maybe a bit more appreciation for what we go through and all the sacrifices that we make. So I think that's been pretty special.
Was there a pride in your performance in that England Italy game last season, Seb? Because although you guys went down, personally, I remember thinking at the time how well you'd gone.
Yeah, I think so. I always I always want to do well personally. That's just the, you know, the nature of sport. Obviously, I was gutted, you know, and I have been gutted on numerous occasions.
A lot can happen in the next 3 years. Like a chatbot may be your new best friend. But what won't change? Needing health insurance. UnitedHealthcare Tri-Term Medical Plans are available for these changing times. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they offer budget-friendly, flexible coverage for people who are in between jobs or missed open enrollment. The plans last nearly 3 years in some states, with access to a nationwide network of doctors and hospitals. So for whatever tomorrow brings, UnitedHealthcare Tri-Term Medical Plans may be for you. Learn more at uh1.com.
When you're ready to pop the question, the last thing you want to do is second-guess the ring. At BlueNile.com, you can design a one-of-a-kind ring with the ease and convenience of shopping online. Choose your diamond and setting. When you find the one, you'll get it delivered right to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off your purchase. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
Hi, this is Craig Robinson from Ways to Win. And support for this podcast comes from Invesco QQQ, the official ETF of the NCAA. Invesco QQQ is proud to sponsor this episode and even prouder to provide access to innovation for the last 25 years. Basketball has had innovations over the years, too. We're seeing the game played in new ways every day. Learn more at Invesco.com/QQQ. Let's rethink possibility. Invesco Distributors, Inc.
Playing for Italy, you know, when you haven't got over the line and you've given it everything. So, I think it was special for me also because of what had happened, you know, leading up into that game. You know, the last time I played against England, I'd got a horrific head injury, you know, which took me a long time to get over. Not only the symptoms that I had, you know, with waking up, you know, vomiting and headaches and yeah, just not being at the races, really. That had a massive effect on me and also the people that were close to me because they could see that I wasn't myself. And then to get that confidence again to keep going and then, you know, just going into that in-game just thinking, you know, I just want to give it everything and hopefully everything turns out okay. And, you know, I was really proud of how I did it individually, but I also think, you know, that second half fight that we showed against England was pretty special. And when you perform as a team, it just makes everything, you know, better. And yeah, there's just a better feeling.
Zooming out, Seb, on Italy as a team, on you guys as a team, yeah. You've shown a lot of promise and you've won a lot of fans over the last year with the way that you've played.
Yeah.
And I mentioned this to Michele on at the Six Nations launch. The World Cup must have hurt in the way that finished.
Yeah.
Can you talk to me about where you feel you are as a team with that in mind?
Yeah, it definitely hurt us because, you know, we had worked so hard to get a lot of respect and credibility back, and we genuinely believed that we had the tools and the talent in the team to put a better performance in it against France and New Zealand. And to be fair, if you look at the whole World Cup, we probably weren't at the races for most of it. We didn't really have a convincing performance against Namibia. Against Uruguay, it was the second half performance that got us over the line. And then, you know, we let ourselves down. And there's no one else you can blame. I'm not going to sit here and say, you know, the staff weren't fully with us or something happened during the week. We got to take responsibility as players and we let ourselves down. And now we have an opportunity, the Six Nations, to make it right. Because over the last 12 to 18 months, you touched on it, that we have gained, you know, a lot of fans through the way we play. And, you know, I don't think there's many teams out there that take Italy lightly, which is a really good thing and a step forward. But now it's the next step is about getting results. And, you know, that's how you judged at the end of the day. So we know full well as players what's expected of us. And we're looking forward to it. We're under no illusions that the Six Nations tournament is going to be tough, like every Six Nations tournament. But we got to take that step further and put some performances that we're really proud of on the back of having two really poor performances and results in the World Cup.
every team goes through some kind of renewal, I guess, at the start of a World Cup cycle. And it's going to be an England team without Courtney Laws and without Owen Farrell, among others. Does that change things? And does it change how you view England as a challenge?
Absolutely not. We haven't spoken about who's missing, who's come in. You know, we're playing England. They're the third best team in the world. You know, they're a dangerous team now with one or two attacking players that they've got, Marcus and other guys that like to throw the ball around. And then they've got a really good set piece. And when you have a really good set piece at international level, it just sets the whole tone for the game. They've got a really good maul, good scrum, good pack. And they've got guys that are in the Prem that are informed. So we're under no illusions, and thinking about who they're missing and who's not playing. We're playing England, and it's always one of the toughest. And, you know, I think I've played England on 6 or 7 occasions, and every single one of those games has been, you know, physical, hard, and really, really tough. So, yeah, we're under no illusions.
Seb, good luck for the weekend and the rest of the championship, and thank you so much for your time.
No, pleasure, Charlie. Thanks so much, mate.
Thanks, Charlie. Great to hear from Italy, Sebastian Negri there. And we're now going to speak to Eddie Jones, the new Japan head coach, to get all his thoughts on his new role in the Six Nations. Hi, Eddie. Whereabouts are you?
Currently in Italy, mate, in Florence. So it's not a bad spot.
Very nice. Is that for a bit of scouting ahead of later this year? How come you're over there?
Just to have a look at England and Italy this week, and just spending a bit of time with one of the players I used to coach at Saracens, who's coaching at Benetton.
Oh, okay. Which one's that?
Fabio Ongara.
Oh, yes. Yeah, I remember him. Oh, very good.
Yeah, so just catching up to him, have a bit of a chat and find out about Italian rugby.
What does he make of it?
We're just about to catch up, mate. I just arrived.
Oh, great. Brilliant. It's good to talk to you again. We last spoke in November, and now you're in charge of Japan. I remember when everyone remembers sort of Brighton and that famous day from your first stint with Japan. But I know that when you joined in 2012, a lot of work went into getting the team into that kind of position where they can pull off that famous result in installing that fast, expansive style. Are you now that you're back with Japan, are you starting from sort of a stronger point than then? And what are your priorities in the role?
I think there's a number of things that's improved, mate. If you look at the standard of the top domestic league, which is now called League One, that's improved remarkably. Like, yeah, you look at the quality of the top four teams and it's, you know, not a bad standard at all. But then you look at the World Cup squad, and whilst I was taking over a squad in 2011, that still had players that could go on to 2015, which is always an advantage. Now, if you look at the squad in 2023, it was one of the oldest squads at the World Cup. So, yeah, that means that we've got to rebuild and bring younger players through. Fast-tracking young players in Test rugby is a challenging part of coaching, a challenging part for any national team. So we're looking forward to taking on that challenge.
When we spoke in November, you talked about how in your next role you wanted to, that you weren't really liking the way the game was played and you wanted to try and do things a bit differently and change the game a bit. Can you sort of elaborate how you're hoping to do that with Japan now that you're on board there?
Well, I think, you know, you always want to play a little bit differently. The status quo is in place and it's generally in place because that's been a system that's been in place for a number of years. The players are equipped to handle that. And if you try to play that sort of rugby, all you're doing is playing catch-up, you know, which has been that power-based high kicking game, and South Africa evolved it to another step at the World Cup with their exceptional counter attack and their exceptional transitional play, which took it to a new level. But with Japan, we're going to have to play differently, because we're going to have a smaller team than the rest of the world. And I think, you know, historically, if you look at when Japan's been successful in 2015, 2019, particularly, they played a style of game that was a little bit different from everyone else. So we need to go back to the past to create the future, but we also need to add on some more strategic elements to our game. You know, we at the moment now in rugby, as we know, it's almost impossible to play continuously long phases of rugby, which Japan was very good at. You know, very little teams progress post the quarterfinals playing that sort of rugby. So you've got to play much quicker. You've got to play with pace. So we've got to add that to our game and add a strategic kicking game to it.
Any players in particular who you're quite excited by, kind of younger players who we might not be familiar with over here in the UK?
Well, I could name them, but they won't mean much to you, mate.
Hey, you're playing England twice this year. We're going to see some of them.
Yeah, no, you will. There's two or three good young tens around, which is obviously such a crucial position. And it's been really fascinating in the League One here, you know, watching three of the best players have all been Japanese size. Cheslin Kolbe, Richard Mwanga and Quagga Smith, you know, have all been absolutely outstanding. But they're all little guys. You know, Mwanga's 80 Ks, Cheslin Kolbe's 76 Ks, Quagga Smith plays at 94 Ks. So it shows where the level of the game can go, and that's what we've got to aspire our Japanese players to be thinking about. To think not just to be good in Japan, but to be, can they challenge to be good in, you know, as one of the world's best?
When we chatted in November, there was so much speculation about you and Japan and whether that was where you were going to go. And it had been going back for weeks and months into the World Cup. Are you sort of happy now to sort of set the record straight in terms of how that all played out and how you ended up with Japan and when those first conversations happened?
Oh, well, I think I've covered all of that, mate. I don't look back with it with any feeling that I've been anything but upfront with Australia. Australia knew what was going on. I never had any intention to leave Australia, but when Australia wasn't able to fulfil their obligations, and we've seen today, I think the Rebels have gone bankrupt. It's a tough time for Australia, but, you know, to progress from where they are, they need to get things together, and that means that they've got to make some hard decisions and they've got to develop their players differently.
There's a Stan Sport unveiled a trailer for a documentary that's coming out, which was filmed sort of during the World Cup. What are you sort of expecting from that? Have you seen any of it, and what are you expecting to sort of come out of it as well?
I've got no idea and don't really care, mate. You know, that's all history now.
Will you watch it at all?
Probably not. And I moved on, mate. You know, and I think one of the things you've got to do in rugby, in any role you've got, whether it be a coach or a player, you know, if you keep on looking back over your shoulder and keep wanting to either go back or escape from what it was, it doesn't treat you at all well in what you're doing now. So I've just got to move on. You know, I had my time in Australia. I had a go. You know, we've spoken about there was reasons for it not working out as it did, but I take full responsibility for it and move on, mate. But I don't want to look back now.
Sure. Yeah. With the Six Nations coming up, England are not going to have Owen Farrell there, who was obviously your captain for so long, and he's announced that he won't be playing in the Six Nations because he's taking a break for his mental well-being and his family's mental well-being. I just wondered what you made of that situation and the fact that he's now going to Racing as well, and he won't be an England player from the summer. What do you make of how that's played out?
Well, I think it's a sad indictment on how we operate as a society now. You know, I think, you know, you couldn't get a more committed, hard-working, diligent player than Owen Farrell. You know, and his record as a point scorer, I don't know where he sits now, but he's, you know, he's obviously up there in the top three, isn't he? So, you know, he's one of the greats of our game. And the fact that, yeah, we don't know the reason why he's dropping out, but we do know what happened during the World Cup, you know, where he was booed consistently by fans, and, you know, there was some context that, you know, even his own fans could have been booing him. He's been attacked and his family's been attacked on social media. For what? You know, because he's a hard, hard, committed player. He's being attacked for that. So, yeah, all of that doesn't sit well. But as we know, social media is not going to go back, mate. It's going to keep going forward. And it'll reach the nth degree and then someone will pull it back, as what happens with all of these things.
Have you spoken to him at all since that decision? Or...
We've had some text messages, yeah.
It's going to be... it means that England is sort of in this a bit of a rebuild now with Jamie George as captain. You've obviously worked closely with him. How do you think he'll get on in the role?
Yeah, Jamie will do a good job, mate. But, you know, I think, you know, Steve's got the inevitable task of rebuilding England in a high expectation, high demand environment. And I'm sure he's going to do a good job. And Jamie will do a good job bringing the team through. You know, in reality, that team's been going through transition since 2021. And it's been a long transition period. And, you know, you've got to congratulate the players on what they did at the World Cup in 2023. I thought they, you know, played some really good, tough English rugby. And I'm sure they're going to do that in the Six Nations. I'm sure Jamie will get the best out of the team.
There's quite a few uncapped players in this squad. I think about seven of them. I wondered if any of them were on your radar when you were still with England. Someone like Finn Smith, for example, who we might see starting against Italy this weekend.
Yeah, look, he was just coming through. You know, he'd been playing for Worcester, and obviously Worcester were, you know, not performing greatly, so it was difficult for him, but. He just moved to Northampton when I was about to leave, and, you know, was showing signs of developing his game. He's a, you know, he's got a good skill set, good kicking game, quite a mature, calm player, and one of those young tens that seems to have experience already. You know, a bit like an Owen Farrell type. So he'll probably make the jump to Test rugby quicker than the more instinctive tends do, like a Mwanga or a Marcus Smith.
And I was going to ask you a bit of a cheeky question, but in hindsight, who was easier to work with? There are a few, or Rugby Australia, given you both worked for them recently.
Look, mate, I've found the longer I've worked, I've found every union to be the same. Yeah, they all want to do well. Yeah, some have got more resources than others. The politics of the unions are the same. They just have different colours, different jackets, you know, different leather patches on their elbows. But it's very much the same, mate.
And facing England twice this year, you looking forward to that?
Well, I think it's fantastic for Japan. Yeah, if you consider again, 8 years ago with Japan. Japan was the joke country of world rugby. You know, everyone could play against them. You know, they'd play their B team against them at the World Cup and beat them by 70 points. And now they've got, you know, we've got a fixture list of two England first and last game, and we've got France and New Zealand in between. So we've got the full buffet, mate.
With the Six Nations kicking off, do you miss it, all the intensity and the rivalries of it? It's quite a crazy 7 week period, isn't it, when it's all going on?
It is a fantastic competition. So I don't miss it, but it's a fantastic competition to be involved in.
I'm sure 2016 and the Grand Slam would be your highlight. I just wondered what other favourite memories you sort of have from it?
Well, I think it's always the games where you played really well. I can remember, I'm just trying to think of the year. It was either 2017 where we played Ireland first up, maybe.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, we hadn't been able to beat them. And we came out of the blocks really quickly and got 20 points on them early and played some really good rugby that day. I think any of those games against, you know, France and Ireland are always the highlights where you've got to play well to beat them.
And if I asked you just for a prediction in terms of a winner this year, who do you think looks strongest and will probably end up with the title?
Yeah, well, I think, you know, post the World Cup, it's always a difficult year to predict because you don't know how teams come up. You know, I remember in 2020, we were a long way from our best because we still had a bit of a 2019 hangover. But, we, you know, in that COVID interrupted, we still managed to win the Six Nations in 2020. So I would think, you know, the strongest teams have been France and Ireland, and they will have a bit of a World Cup hangover. You know, France have obviously missing Dupont, Ireland are missing Sexton, and England are missing Farrell. So they're, you know, they're three talisman players that are missing from those teams. So each of those three teams, how they cope with missing that player, and more so not only their play but also their leadership, I think is going to be important. You know, Dupont's one of those more, you know, adventurous type leader because of the way he plays, you know, and I think he inspires his players to give more. Sexton was the coordinated, calm, you know, we know where we're going. And no one had a bit of the fire and brimstone plus being, you know, exceptionally tough player himself. So they'll all miss that. And who can fill the gap the quickest, or I think, will be the team that wins out of that. So I'm not giving you a very good answer. It's about as close as I can get.
It almost feels like a title decider on the first game, on the first night, doesn't it, with Ireland going to Marseille to face France, and whoever comes out of that will be...
Yeah, well I think you get a pretty good indication of where both teams are early in the comp because of that. You know, England with Italy probably came through, were probably one of the most disappointing countries at the World Cup, you know, because they had played really well. They've got a new coach in Caseda who'll bring a much different approach to the game than what Kieran wanted Italy to play. You know, Italy were a high passing game. I would imagine under Caseda they're going to be much more of a running, kicking team, a bit more of a set piece. And it'll be interesting to see whether they can reach the heights that they did under Kieran.
So France to win it, if I push you?
I would think so, mate. I would think so. But I think it's gonna go down the wire. Might be one of those ones that's decided on the last round.
Yeah. And will you watch the games as much as you can? I know you're in Italy now, so you
I watch every game with interest. I'm going out there on Saturday to have a look because we're playing both of them, which will be good. You know, and there's usually 40,000 English fans there.
Should be a good turnout. Eddie, thanks so much for your time. Great to hear from you.
Good on you, Ben.
Cheers. Thank you
very much. Nice to chat to you again.
Cheers.
Keep well. Thanks, boys.
Thanks for your time, Eddie. Great to hear from you. Let's look ahead now to the rest of the weekend's matches.
Okay, it's quite an appealing opening weekend of the Six Nations, I think, mainly because of this very spicy Friday night game. Oh, yeah. In, where is it, Charles?
Marseille.
Why is it not in Paris?
Because of the 2024 Summer Olympics, France have moved all their games around the country, so they face Ireland in Marseille, Italy in Lille, and England, Le Crunch, in the final weekend in Lyon.
France, Ireland then to open. Let's talk about... Oh, this is a great question to pose to you two. Who is the bigger miss, Dupont for France or Sexton for Ireland? Charlie?
Sexton for Ireland, Ben.
Oh, good answer. Why?
Because France have Luku, who arguably is a nicer fit for Mathieu Jalibert, who will be their 10, their club colleagues at Bordeaux. And I just think there's more of an unknown with how Ireland go about replacing Sexton. It looks like Jack Crowley, doesn't it? Who's gonna be 10 in his stead. Lots of swagger about Jack Crowley. Nice, neat kicking game. As I say, lots about him, but there's just that question mark, and in such a pivotal position, they're obviously going to have to. They're just not going to be the same side because of how pivotal and how influential Johnny Sexton has been to them. Another big miss, I think, is Matt Canson, potentially an underrated miss. He's like that They have loads of playmakers, don't they? Keenan's fantastic at fullback for them as well. But in that sort of multifaceted attack with that kind of unpredictable phase play, and you know, layers of runners all over the shop, Hansen buzzing around just ties it all together so nicely. And he had a phenomenal Six Nations last season. So big miss there too.
I find Crowley fascinating because it felt like they were searching for the success of quite a while, and they've tried so many players. And actually, it's quite a short and sharp apprenticeship for Jack Crowley. Like, he's only got 9 caps. It was autumn of 2022, I think, or maybe that summer where he first came in. Mm-hmm. So he has sort of been given the keys to what otherwise, Hansen being absent, is still a fairly strong side on paper, Charles, from the looks of things.
No, it definitely is. People are coming back for more. And I mean, Crowley was against Finn Smith in that Munster Northampton game as well. And he actually, you know, Finn Smith completely outplayed him. Not meaning to go, you know, harp on too much, just going back to that. But I wasn't actually too impressed by Crowley that evening. And I did think, is he really the man to be the heir to Sexton? I'm not sure, but I mean, this is just going to be an absolute humdinger on Friday night, isn't it? You said it was spicy. It's Vindaloo levels of spice, I think. Just neither. We've already spoken quite a bit in this podcast about momentum in the Six Nations, and I think neither team will want to lose on Friday night for obvious reasons, in that you just never want to lose a game of rugby, and because both are looking to avenge, or at least move on from, disappointing World Cup placings, but also in terms of the scope of the championship as a 5-round affair, you don't want to lose the first game, because then you basically have to win the second game to keep your championship hopes alive. And where do France go on the second weekend there at Murrayfield on the second weekend? Is that correct?
Yeah, that's
right. You know they would be favourites for that game, but again, not a foregone conclusion for them to go there and win. Really not.
I don't know what Harry Burns' fitness status is, but I wonder, chatting about the Finn Smith combinations with his Northampton teammates, I wonder if he was fit, whether they just would have gone, right, you've got Gibson Park and loads of Leinster players around you, let's just slot you into this back line ahead of Crowley, and just keep that kind of Leinster feel for a bit of continuity, especially given, you say, I mean, we've spoken about Marseille before, because I think we've all covered matches there now, and it's probably up there as one of our favourite venues to see a test match, because it's just wild, isn't it? So that's fascinating for Ireland. I think we're all fairly settled on that these two teams, one of them is going to win the whole thing.
Yeah.
And probably France, because they're at home. Is that, Charlie, where you're leaning at the moment?
That's where I'm leaning. Scotland having France at home after they go to Wales, two wins there. As you say, not a foregone conclusion, and they've troubled France in various ways over the last couple of years. In numerous times they've played each other, they went back to back. I know they were only World Cup warm ups, but Scotland were fantastic in France for a lot of that game too. They could certainly break up that order, but yeah, I think I'm with you at the minute that it's those two battling out for one and two.
Scotland are actually the team that interests me the most. I know that might sound a bit strange, because they actually are the team that hasn't gone through the most change. Like, they're not missing as many big hitters. I know Darcy Graham might be out for, I think, potentially the first couple of games with an injury, but the core of their side is still there. They're not trying to replace anybody, which actually makes you think, come on, Scotland, like, finally.
25 years.
Can we see a title charge? Like, can you win in Cardiff against Wales, which actually on paper doesn't sound like that hard a task given where Wales are, but it's something that they don't do enough. It's something they haven't done for an age, I don't think. Can you beat France at home, having come really close in 2020, I think it was? Like, they need to start winning these games. I want to take them more seriously. I want to believe that they're title contenders. Yeah. This has got to be the time.
I hope this isn't the case, because I hope there are more twists and turns along the way over the course of the next couple of months. But it does feel like the winner on Friday night wins the whole thing. But I really do hope that that isn't the case, and it isn't as much of a foregone conclusion, there we go again, as that. I really hope that there's more intrigue to the whole championship than simply Italy losing 5 matches and either France or Ireland winning all 5 matches after winning in Marseille on Friday night. You know, you do hope there is more intrigue than that, especially after the World Cup, where it was an all Southern Hemisphere final, can we have a bit of drama? A bit of drama and a bit of intrigue, please.
Yeah. We had to do our predicted tables, didn't we? And I kind of, I thought top bracket, France, Ireland, middle bracket, England, Scotland, bottom bracket, Wales, Italy. And I just hope one of them jumps between them. That'd be fun, wouldn't it?
Yeah.
To correct myself, 2022, Scotland lost to France. They beat them in 2020. But I just think if they can win, I mean, you can win in Cardiff. You could potentially beat France at home at Murrayfield. We're not mad about England, given the changes that England have got going on in their selection at the moment, and if the fact that it feels England at the start of a cycle. Then you play Italy. Oh, God, I'm starting to believe it. And then
Ireland are just the perennial.
And then you go to Dublin at the end.
Who do, aren't they?
I don't know.
Oh, yeah, they've been bullied and sort of just mugged by Ireland. That's like, horribly, in various ways.
That's the big final boss, isn't it? Quite aptly in the final round, and also because their record against them is not great.
Every side has got either a new 10, a new coach, or a new captain, right? And Scotland have got same coach, same 10, but they've
had the luxury of changing.
Made their 10 the captain.
Had the luxury of changing their captain just because they've taken it off Jamie Ritchie and given it to...
Who is still in the squad.
Yeah. Yeah, they just decided to go in new people, which is actually not something that other teams have been able to do.
No. I mean, are we sort of convincing ourselves here of Scotland Grand Slam World Cup win 2027?
No, absolutely not. And I've been fooled before by Scotland. So chat to me next Monday when we're back in the studio after I've seen Wales put 20 on them in Cardiff or whatever, and it's all in tatters. I'm just getting a bit frustrated that this seems to be a very talented group, and I feel like there's more that they can deliver. That's all I'm saying. And we should chat about Wales actually as well, given that's the game on Saturday, the late game in Cardiff, which Wales is such an interesting place. I love this. I feel a bit bad for David Jenkins that he's sort of being talked about as Alan Wynne Jones Mark II. And Warren Gatland sort of suggested that last week when he said he's a captain in the mould of Alan Wynne Jones. And you almost think, well, don't say that. Just say that he's quite a quiet, kind of determined captain. But these are the standards that are being set for him to follow. The Reece Samit news, I think, the shock of that, I think, has probably already subsided. As in, obviously, he would have been in their plans to play. He would have been a key figure in that back line. He's such a threat. At 22, this cycle might have been the cycle where he's already achieved so much, but maybe the four-year cycle where he took over the world. At the moment, he's not there. Let's see how the NFL thing pans out. Who knows? I think the fact there's no Dan Bigger at fly half, the fact there's no Jack Morgan, that people are forgetting. Like, Jack Morgan's not there because of knee surgery. Like, he was in a pretty good World Cup campaign for Wales. He was the best player by a mile. I think he even ended up in a lot of team of the tournaments as well at the end. He was fantastic. So therefore, Charles' expectations are quite low about Wales, aren't they? But that's probably exactly what Warren Gatland wants.
Yeah, no, absolutely. I think there is a little bit of that siege mentality there. I think expectations are low, but at least they don't have to go to France. You know, they will have France at home, and they will have Italy at home as well. I know that didn't make much of a difference 2 years ago, but you know, these are games. The Italy game could be another must win for them. And the fact that the Italians have to travel to Cardiff, you know, Wales will be, regardless of what happens, you'd expect Wales to be favourites for that game. But yeah, I mean, expectations are low for Wales, would we say? Is that fair enough? I think that they are in that bottom bracket with Italy this season, but also perfectly happy to be proven wrong, would love to be proven wrong, because they've got some quality young talent. I mean, Daffy Jenkins has been sublime for Exeter this season in the second row. Tommy Reffel gets better with every game for Leicester when he can stay fit. Sam Costello looks like he has potential to be a real leading light at fly half. Nick Tompkins has looked real good for Saracens, as he always does. You know, there are real good players there, and you just hope that for such a rich rugby country, you hope that they don't start. This isn't the start of a sort of gradual decline for them, and you hope that there is a real strong future for Welsh rugby.
They should have been in the World Cup semi-final, shouldn't they? They were created enough to beat Argentina. Created enough line breaks. Couldn't convert them, and the line out went to pot. But then so much has changed since then. So it's difficult. It's almost like they're starting again. And yeah, I am pessimistic about them. I have to say,
Scotland's last win at the Millennium Stadium. Anybody? 2002.
No.
It's 2002. Scotland, please.
Okay.
This is it. This has got to be it. Right, let's wrap up that section and have some of your questions. Okay, before we start the questions, just reacting to some developing news as we sit here in the podcast studio, which is that Midi Olympique are reporting that Courtney Laws is just a signature away from signing for Breathe next season. Charles, that feels like a classic club for Courtney Laws to join in France. If you'd said to me Courtney Laws is going to join a French club, for some reason in my head, Breathe seems like a perfect fit. That's going to be, from a Breathe angle, can you tell us a bit about Breathe and what they're up to at the moment?
Yeah, I can. I didn't think I'd be doing that on this Six Nations preview.
That's the game.
So they're second division French club. Obviously, they're European champions in 1997. They yo-yo quite regularly between the top 14 and the Pro Ligue 2, the second division. They have a wealthy owner who's an Englishman, Ian Osborne, and they've got grand designs. They're a very, very ambitious club. They want to get straight back into the top 14. They're currently, off the top of my head, I'm going to go sixth in the Pro Ligue 2 table. They're certainly in and around the playoff spots. They had a really ropey start to the season under Patrice Calazzo, the coach. He was sacked. Pierre-Henri Brancon, the former CAS coach, who was Eddie Jones's Moor coach with Australia, has now, I think they've won five of their last six matches. They're right back into the playoff spots for the Pro Ligue 2. And I imagine that Courtney Laws will have been offered quite a lucrative contract and offer to go there, and they're a very ambitious club and a rugby mad town. I've never actually been to the town or the ground, but by all accounts, I think something silly like a third of the town's population go and watch. If the stadium is full, it that comprises a third of the town's population. And good luck to him. Why not? I'm sure he'll be a great fit. It's a shame for English rugby. It's a shame for the Premiership. It's a shame for Northampton, because I did think that he might end his career as a one-club man. But clearly he wants to go and experience something else, and you can't begrudge him that.
Now, to actually get into your questions, we had one from Elliot, which was to say, which young player will have a breakthrough season in this year's tournament? We've actually all picked kind of predictions for the tournament, and I don't know when they're going to be up online, but you'll see them at some point. But because of that, that means we can tell you who we've picked for our breakthrough player. So, Charlie, start with you. Who have you gone for?
I went with Joe McCarthy, and Elliot might agree with me because I actually bumped into him at that game.
Yeah. Oh, great.
That's yeah. Good. So he was, his athleticism and dynamism in that game for Leinster was eye-popping, and he's got a nasty streak about him as well, which all big enforcer locks, it tends to be quite handy. He's grown a mullet. I'm all in on him. He's got a handful of caps for Ireland and hasn't played in Six Nations yet, I don't believe. So it'd be his first taste of the tournament. And Andy Farrell has potential headaches around the back five and how he configures that, and McCarthy's capable of smashing all that up and being a starter, I think.
Did a mullet genuinely come into the thinking?
Yeah, he looked
nails
genuinely scary.
Trying to choose those players isn't easy. Sometimes you just need something to tip you over the line.
Fine margins.
Speaking of scary, I went with Emmanuel Mayafu, the uncapped French lock, who also qualifies for New Zealand and Australia, but he says he's France through and through, wants to play for France. He's been at Toulouse for the past two or three seasons and has been tearing it up over there.
When can we expect to see him?
Yes, this is the annoyingly. Yeah. I've slightly shot myself in the foot because he's not fit for this Friday night's match against Ireland, and he might not be fit for the Scotland game either. I think he's due to play at least three matches for France. I think that he would have started this Friday night had he been fit. He's sort of filling that because they're missing Thibaut Flamand in the second row as well, and he had leapfrogged Paul Willemse in the pecking order. Willemse is now back. He's the more likely of France's two gargantuan locks that they've called up, Pasolo Twilangi, Manu's nephew.
Yes.
The other one, Mayafu, we are much more likely to see Mayafu, I think, just because he's played more high level elite rugby. And his impact on that Toulouse team has been sensational. I think he's got, for a man who is so big, I think he's got the most jackal turnovers in the Champions Cup this season, which is staggering when I found that out.
Elliot actually suggested Tuilagi, who, like you say, only 19 and over 23 stone. So when he does get involved, we're going to notice.
Because... I've met him, actually. And he's a lovely, lovely, lovely bloke.
Excellent.
And I was expecting... I rolled out my sort of my best French, and he just replied saying, I speak English, bro.
Sweet. Okay, that's good.
And I was like, oh, okay, let's do English then.
I also went with the French player. I went with Nolan Le Garec, the young scrum half from Racing. I watched him in a Champions Cup quarterfinal against Sale about 18 months ago, where he bossed the show, and I thought, it's not fair that France basically get to have this much scrum half depth and that he's coming through to rival Dupont. I think, like we've said, Maxime Lucas will start, but Le Garec, who can goal kick as well, will come off the bench and most likely close out games for France during the tournament. And yeah, he looks really impressive, still just 21. Simon sent us five questions, so I'm going to read them all out and we're going to pick two. They are, in order, how much of a drop-off should we expect from Ireland? Which France is going to turn up? Why are Italy one to watch? Fixture list-wise, is this England's year? And any indication if the Netflix stock is cut through? Well, we've sort of done Netflix, and we've sort of done... We've touched on Ireland a bit. Let's chat a bit more about Italy, because we haven't done that yet. And Charlie, your new best mate, Gonzalo Quesada, clearly made an impression on you at the launch. So what did he sort of set out that he wants from his team, as well as that aggressive defence?
It was sort of more stability and solidity with regard to defence, and Michele Lamaro, I kind of invited him to talk about the World Cup if he wanted to at that launch, and he did. And he said things like, they're moments that we'll never forget. Anybody that was a part of those two losses will never forget them. And they were chastening. I wasn't at either of them. I was on my shuttles back to the UK, so I was watching them from the UK, and they were horrible. So if you're taking out those... just those lapses, you'd expect Quesada to do that. You'd expect him to maybe add a little bit in the kicking game. I was just having a look at the stats actually earlier today. Italy had by quite a decent way the fewest kicking meters per game, and you did just as much as they're under Crowley. The way they moved the ball was fantastic, and the patterns that they were kind of running in phase play, really fun with those kind of playmakers and Capuazzo like swinging across the field in deeper layers to attack. You did just sense sometimes that they played the way, certainly at Twickenham, played their way into trouble a bit. I would expect them to be a little bit more pragmatic and to play, to make sure that they're playing, they're running those patterns in better areas and more pragmatic areas of the field. And that could be the difference, you know. That could allow them to really, really stick in with teams. They stuck in with France last year. They stuck in with England last year They stuck in with Scotland last year for decent periods and were right in the mix at the end of that game. Could get them over the line.
And Charles, if I pick a second question from Simon, if I pick which France are going to turn up, I imagine the answer is probably a very good one and a very ticked off one at how things panned out at the Rome World Cup.
Yeah, I think that's a fair assessment. I think we're, sorry Simon, but I think we're actually now getting to the point where that question can be sort of filed in the cabinet and left there forever, because I think we're going to have a pretty good France for years and years to come. They're dominating age group level, and the club game is the most elite of any country in the world, and you know, they were knocked out of the World Cup in the quarterfinal by the eventual champions in a game that could have gone either way. So I think they're going to be perennially dangerous, probably for the rest of, hopefully for the rest of our lifetimes, because a good France means just good global rugby, I think.
I don't think we've said it yet, just a very, very finish on the last note. France Grand Slam? Like, if they beat Ireland on Friday, which I think we're leaning towards, then why not?
Because it just bigged up Scotland so much.
Yeah. it's their year of three games at home, so.
Charlie, you can't trust Scotland. Come on.
Scotland Grand Slam?
Right, that's it for today. Thank you, Charlie. Thank you, Charles. A big thanks to Eddie Jones and Sebastian Negri for speaking with us too to help us preview the Six Nations. Thanks to you for downloading the podcast. If you're new here, welcome along, and make sure to tell all the rugby mad friends in your life about what we're doing. The three of us will be here every week throughout the Six Nations, and we'll be joined by some top guests along the way as well. That's all for this week. Enjoy the opening weekend of Six Nations action, and we'll catch you next week. Goodbye.
Thank you.
Hi, this is Craig Robinson from Ways to Win, and support for this podcast comes from Invesco QQQ, the official ETF of the NCAA. The future isn't scary. Not realizing its potential, however, could be. Just like on the recruiting trail, I've seen potential come in many forms as a coach. Learn more at Invesco.com/QQQ. Let's rethink possibility. Invesco Distributors, Inc.